Welcome to the All Souls Forum. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. Tonight's conversation addresses end-of-life issues and the choices, rights, and options that are available to minimize suffering and facilitate a peaceful passing. Most of us don't want to think about death and dying, but our speakers, retired physician Ann Allegra and Dr. John Carney, CEO of Practical Bioethics in Kansas City, keep this heavy topic light as they explain why our healthcare system has complicated the dying process and how we can chart a better course for ourselves and our loved ones. This show was recorded on Sunday, April 9th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Following our usual format, we will begin with the presentation, take a short break, and then wrap things up with questions from the audience. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
Good morning. Welcome to the forum. My name is Craig Vollen, a member of the forum committee. The forum exists to afford a platform for the discussion of significant issues, especially those which involve ethical values in the contemporary world. This morning is a very interesting topic that we're all going to have to deal with at one time or another. And we have two really top experts in that field. One is John Carney, who's the CEO of the Center for Practical Bioethics in Kansas City. And the other is someone that many of you know, is Ann Allegra, who retired a year ago January as a hospice physician. So I'll now hand it over to them.
Thank you, Craig. We're delighted to be here. I've known Ann probably close to 15, 20 years now, something like that. So, and my work has been in aging, end of life, hospice and palliative care since the mid-80s. So I've been around the block, mostly in Kansas, but also in the nation's capital, done a lot of policy work and that kind of stuff. So this is a very important topic, and it's an area that there's a lot of disagreement on in the United States. So we look forward to your questions, and we're going to be doing many presentations and then engage in a dialogue, because we know you guys are a very educated audience and have lots of good questions for us.
And I know many of you, and I suspect that I know where many of you stand on the topic of aid in dying. So John and I will present maybe a little variance in the views around that, and hopefully we can educate each other.
This is Desmond Tutu on the issue of aid in dying.
Hello, dear sisters and brothers. As a Christian, I believe in the sanctity of life, and that death is a part of life. I hope that when the time comes, I am treated with compassion and allowed to pass on to the next phase of life's journey in the manner of my choice. My friend, Lord Carey, has passionately argued for an assisted dying law in the United Kingdom. His initiative has my blessing and support, as do similar initiatives in my home country, South Africa, in the United States, New Zealand, and parts of the European Union, and right across the world. People who are terminally ill should have the option of dignified and compassionate assisted dying alongside the wonderful palliative care that already exists. I pray that politicians, lawmakers, and religious leaders have the courage to support the choices terminally ill citizens make in departing Mother Earth with dignity and love. God bless you.
Well, there you have it. This was, I don't think, a total surprise to everybody on the planet, but I think it took many of us by surprise that he was, that Desmond came out so in favor of it, given the fact that the long-term Christian tradition, especially those of us that live in the United States, who've significantly felt the impact of religious women, Catholic religious women, in the creation of the American hospital system, and the kind of the predominant view in that arena that this is not an option that Americans should welcome or pursue. And so it gave us a lot of pause for thought in terms of the discussion that's going on. Many of you probably know in the last couple of years that we went from about 2% of the American population having available to them the option of aid in dying, primarily through the medical profession, assisted aid in dying from physicians, the acceptance in California of the law to now about 10% of Americans. And there's some speculation that once we hit the 15%, we're really going to be seeing a trend, kind of that tipping point, and that it'll become much more acceptable in the United States. And the percentages in terms of acceptance by Americans has shifted dramatically over the last 10 years. So there's a lot more people that are welcoming, and at least of the discussion, if certainly not. I think one of the concerns that I have, and I think I probably share it with Anne, is Dr. Tutu's reference to alongside palliative care, which exists. In theory, yes. In practicality, especially in the United States, I'm not so sure about that, and Anne can speak to that clinically. The predominant problem we have in the United States is our dependence on rescue medicine and our love affair with technology, technological imperative, as it's referred to. And that complicates our life, those of us who've dedicated our lives to the care and treatment of those who are facing serious illness and death, and certainly doesn't bode well for us kind of in that clash of those two cultures in the United States. But I think through thoughtful discussion and dialogue and people like yourselves engaging in community activities, we'll be able to bridge that gap. So I'm going to turn it over to Anne.
As many of you know, I come from a background of working with end-of-life care over the last 25 or so years. In Kansas and Missouri, my patients did not have the option of medical assistance in dying. So I've never had to directly face the issue in caring for my patients, but I've certainly given it a lot of thought and talked with a number of people about it. There are a number of reasons why people might choose to hasten their death, and it has to do with a sense of intractable suffering. Like John, I really struggle with the fact that we don't provide good enough palliative care, good enough symptom management, good enough emotional and spiritual support to those who are facing death and to their families. And so assisted dying should never be an excuse for saying, well, we don't need to give you good pain management because you're just going to kill yourself anyway. It should never be an either-or option that you get good palliative care or you get to hasten your death. I'm heartened by the fact that Oregon has kept good statistics on how the law has played out. It became legal in Oregon 20 years ago, 1997. And every year they publish their statistics on how the law is being utilized. It's interesting to me that in Oregon, when they put the law into effect, the use of morphine doubled in the state, the use of hospice went up dramatically, and doctors and other caregivers were really trying to do a better job of addressing the concerns of patients who were nearing the end of life and relieving the suffering. I have friends who work in Oregon in end-of-life care, and they say that having the law on the books makes their discussions much more open. If patients are considering that option, they'll bring it up, and that gives the hospice team a chance to look at what can we do to make things better so that you're not suffering so intensely. The heartening thing about the Oregon law is that only 0.3% of the deaths in Oregon are due to assistance in dying. So even though the death rate didn't change, there are very few people who actually utilize that option. Of the people who actually get prescriptions, 60 to 70% of them go ahead and use them, and the rest just have them on hand in case they feel that things are getting too unbearable. It's also interesting to look at why people go ahead and take that option. And in Oregon, it's not because of pain, it's not because they're not in hospice, it's not because of financial needs, it's because they simply don't see the point in going on. That life has become meaningless, that they don't feel they can participate in things they enjoy any longer, or that they're a burden on people who love them. I have to confess that For myself, I would not want this option. I have family members who definitely would want it, and I'll support people's right to make their own choices. And I'm not sure I can clearly articulate why it doesn't make sense to me. But after being at the bedside of hundreds, if not thousands, of people who are in the process of dying, I feel like there's something in that process that is beneficial. Actually, the time when this conversation came up the most in my hospice practice was when I was working at the hospice house, and I was seeing patients on a daily basis who were in the act of dying. Our average length of stay was 5 days, and over 80% of those patients died during that admission. So most of the people I was seeing were actually within a few days of death. And most of those people, like most of us will be, were pretty much unresponsive and laying there peacefully. And some family members were very discomforted by that and said, oh, she's suffering so much, I just wish we could do what the veterinarians do and get this over. And I didn't see the suffering. It seemed that the family member was the one who was suffering, not the patient. And that this wasn't convenient, it felt out of control. I don't think that we should use killing someone to address those issues. So perhaps we can go from there, John.
Yeah, I want to kind of echo some of Anne's statements. You know, autonomy is a big deal, and we all protect that, you know, in the care that we receive, and we want that kind of thing. But the shared aspects of the care and dependency and those kind of things that Anne was talking about earlier really kind of hit that critical nexus at the time right before death. There's a beautiful piece, a video that Dr. Jeff Peeler did prior to his death. He's a KU physician who was diagnosed with prostate cancer and it recurred and got worse. And this is the physician who built his own coffin. He was in the New York Times a number of years ago, right before his death. And he's talking with the man who's helping him prepare his coffin. And this gentleman, Pete was his name, cared for his mother, his own mother, weeks and months before she died. And Jeff confided in him one time that he was thinking about going ahead and just killing himself prior to the serious aspects of the illness kind of taking over his life. And Pete was very respectful, and he said, you know, I need to think about that a minute. And then about, I think it was 2 weeks later, they were back to, you know, having him sit inside of it, lay inside of it and measure it and all this kind of stuff. It's a beautiful video about how this guy goes through this process of trying to normalize the creation of his casket. But Pete, they engage in a conversation in which Pete says to him, I want you to think about that a little bit more, because if you just disappear from the lives of those you love, it may benefit you, but it may make their life a lot harder in terms of the complications. And so he began to talk with him about how his experience with his mother, who was totally dependent on Pete for her care, provided Pete the opportunity to return the love and care to his mother that he had received from her as a child. And he said it was the most fulfilling experience of his adult life with his mother for the last 2 weeks of her life, which I thought was a beautiful expression of the bounty that's in dependency. And that if we are of the human family and caring for each other in ways, we don't see a child in need of a diaper change as somehow being less dignified than we do, except we would anticipate someone toileting us as being an undignified experience for ourselves. But we still share that. And I, you know, my mom took care of my dad for 26 years, and he was pretty dependent on her 24/7 for most of that time. She never complained about it, though I know it was a lot of work and a lot of burden. And she's very clear with us that she does not want us children to have to do that for her. She's very clear about that. Because she said, I signed up for it when I married him. You didn't sign up for that being born to us. But we've assured her that love and dependence factor is felt as deeply with us as children as we have. So I think it's just a way of looking at it that I thought that Pete did a tremendous job in the video. It's for me, you know, it's all about Jeff, but that part of the video, I think, was just really compelling to me to understand, you know, Ira's five obligations at the end of life, that all of us, regardless of our diagnosis and state of illness, have obligations to each other, to say I love you, to say I'm sorry, to say goodbye, to say please forgive me, and I forgive you. And that's hard work. And even though we may be dependent and sick and dying, those five tasks still need to be done. And if we just disappear before they're done, there are people we love and care for that may be without that. So just kind of a commercial there for the other side of the argument.
Well, and I understand that people don't want to get swept up in the medical system. As you talked about, John, the technological, the rescue imperative, that if you go in the hospital, George, you talked about your mom with her broken hip and how you had to really argue with the doctors because they wanted to fix it. And how hard it is sometimes not to get caught in that, always the medical system always offering and wanting to do more and more. So it's very important that we address that. Now, realistically, here in Kansas and Missouri, you can't go to a doctor and get a prescription to hasten your death. You can commit suicide. That's always a possibility. But medically assisted suicide is not legal. But you can do a lot of things to gain control of your dying. You can start today documenting your wishes and talking to anybody who'd be involved in that decision, your spouse, your children, others who are going to be there when the decisions are made, and tell them what you want, how far you want things to go. You can make sure that someone in that group is going to be a strong advocate, or you bring in somebody else from outside who's going to be a strong advocate, and make sure that that keeps getting addressed, because it keeps getting lost as you get further and further into medical care. You can stay out of the hospital. You don't have to go to the hospital every time you're ill, but you need to find support for symptom relief and that sort of thing. You can certainly advocate for aggressive symptom management. In my hospice career, you know, we put a lot of doses of strong medicine into people, and doses that most doctors never had experienced. And we weren't afraid to use it. And if that's what it took, that's what it took. And there's also an option for people whose symptoms are intractable and are not responding to other interventions of what's called palliative sedation. And that is sedation with medications to the point of being unaware. And that doesn't come up very often that that's necessary. It's often close to the end of life, so it doesn't hasten death at that point. But in my practice, I would use it sparingly, and I would use it for a time-limited period. Let's try sedation for 24 or 48 hours and then lighten it and see if the symptoms recur. And if we're doing things gradually and titrating to symptoms, then we should be able to manage that very well.
And in the final stages of palliative sedation, there's a section or an area called palliative sedation to unconsciousness. And when that happens, there's usually been a decision that this patient is suffering from refractory and intractable pain to the extent that there's real risk for the suffering actually to hasten the death as opposed to anything else. So there's very clear steps that can be taken that with the physician in a legitimate way that allows the patient to be taken to unconsciousness with the expectation that they will not be brought back. You have a significant illness to the extent that illness will cause that patient's death, and therefore there's no problem with taking him to the point of unconsciousness. At that point then, there's a very concerted effort about bringing the family in and everybody in on the same page and say, okay, once that happens, it's likely that we will also make the decision to discontinue hydration and nutrition because the purpose is obviously that the illness is going to take the life of the patient. Those are legitimate, clinically approved ways for doctors like Ann to be involved in those discussions with the families, but there needs to be clear documentation, solid understanding among all the people in the room that those are legitimate ways to address the symptoms that the patient is having.
And let's be very clear, stopping artificial feeding and hydration at that stage usually has no impact on the timing of death, because it's usually being considered very close to the end of life anyway. And the other thing is, most hospice patients, as they near the end of life, are not eating and drinking anyway. I've had people go 30 days on no intake period, not a sip of water. So the bioethicists have addressed this palliative sedation and raised the concern about raised the principle of double effect. And that is, if our intention is to relieve symptoms, then if it hastens death, then that's okay. Well, nobody says that about surgery. If our intention is to relieve symptoms, but you die sooner because you had the surgery or the chemotherapy, nobody's addressing that there. So I think there's this heightened sensitivity around the things we do in palliative care for risks that we accept with other treatments.
And that goes to Anne's point earlier about all of us have the right to refuse treatment. Okay, we are not required to participate in rescue medicine if we choose not to. So that has been since 97 with Glucksberg and then again with Vacco versus Quill. And actually, it really had a precedent in the Cruzan case where Nancy Beth Cruzan's family, you know, argued that she should not have to continue on treatment because she didn't want it. And, you know, you go through the whole thing around, well, we've got to have evidence and that kind of thing. But what happened in that ruling was that we have a right to refuse treatment, but and we do not have a right necessarily for suicide. So there's and that's what the Glucksberg case does, is that there's no constitutional right to due process that allows us to be able to do that. But we are not required to receive treatment. So I know Anne wants to jump in here, but I want to follow up then with the kind of the next phase of, so how then can we choose legitimately in what's called voluntary stopping of eating and drinking, where I actually participate in the decision on my part, not requiring the physician to do anything in terms of that, to say, all right, I'm done and I'm ready to go in terms of, you know, a long 97-year-old with four different chronic diseases and saying, you know, is there a way for me to say, I'm finished and I'm ready to meet my maker or whatever? Can I do that? And so there's some questions about the legitimacy of that, and I want to talk about some distinctions between those with capacity and those without capacity when we get into that. But I know you want to make a further point about them. Heather?
Let me just say about voluntarily stopping eating and drinking. Of course, any of us can make that choice. But it's not so easy to stop all intake. You get thirsty, right, and you might get hungry, and eating might be one of the pleasures that you still have in life. I had a patient come to the hospice house a number of years ago as a kind of a residential patient. He had decided to stop eating and drinking, and his assisted living facility was not happy with that. He was still getting around with a walker, so he came to live with us and be supported. So every day he would get his walker and come out of his room and go through the kitchen area and check out the snacks that the volunteers had brought in. Oh, brown bread, looks like pumpkin bread. That looks pretty good. He'd walk right past them and sit in the family room with his glass of ice water. And that's all he took in. And about 3 weeks later, he was kind of tired of it, so he went back to assisted living and back to eating. I did want to mention that there are limitations in the assisted dying laws that impact some of the situations that we might fear. One of those is that you have to have a six-month prognosis and you have to have the capacity to make your decision for yourself. And I think those are very reasonable restrictions, but it means that most people with dementia, by the time they get to 6 months from the end of life, are no longer able to make their own decisions, and therefore they do not have access to this. It's also possible that there could be coercion by a family member who's tired of care or by providers who feel that that person's life isn't worth living in those circumstances anymore. The disability community has been very concerned about these laws and whether their quality of life is being judged. And as I said, the laws can never be a substitute for good palliative support. In Oregon, it was handled very well, and they increased palliative support. But we have to be cautious about that in a profit-driven medical system.
And if you are interested in what options are available to you at a point in time that you would lose capacity, or if you have, like my wife's family, most of them have either Alzheimer's or develop Alzheimer's or have age-related dementia. And if you are saying, okay, at some point in the future when I can no longer do this or this or this, I want to stop eating and drinking in order for me to make a choice about my haste and death, but I'm not going to be in a position to make that decision, you know, I'm not going to be able to voice that at that time. There is a group out of California called Caring Advocates that does provide guidance in terms of how to ensure that your wishes can be honored if you are in long-term care settings, and that there's still some speculation that even that's legal within the California law, because again, as Anne said, there is no protection for individuals who've lost capacity to have a right to stop, to state that I'm voluntarily stopping and eating and drinking. Now, if a patient refuses, and this happened, my 91-year-old mother went through this. She had advanced dementia, ended up in a nursing home eventually, and they would feed her this kind of porridge that they put in a spoon so it would, you know, they could just lift it up. Doris flung it across the room about three times, and I was the outlaw, obviously. This was my wife's mother, so I was kind of the outlaw in the room, and I said, what do you think that Doris is trying to tell us? And she said, you know, that she doesn't like this spoon. And I said, I think maybe Doris might be trying to tell us something else, is that she's not really hungry, and this may not. And she said, well, we can't stop feeding. This is the nursing home situation, which I'm sure most of you are aware of. We can't stop feeding her. We can't, you know, if we do this, we're going to get dinged or in trouble with the state. And I said, wait a minute. If she's refusing treatment in a way that the only communication she could by flinging the spoon across, and she did it three times, and I mean, porridge was everywhere in the room. And I finally said, do you think this is, and she said, oh, we'd have to immediately recall hospice, and we'd have to move her out of here and move her down to the end of the hall for the hospice room. And I said, well, I don't know that that's such a bad idea. Did you talk to the family about it? And she said, oh, no, but we need to, you know, they have to have 3 days of failed efforts or something like that. And I said, I don't think this family is going to have concerns about that. And they didn't. And she had a beautiful death. But it is an issue, obviously, for families who are facing these kinds of things.
Yeah, but the flip side of that, John, is you have the person who says, okay, when I get dementia, I'm going to stop eating and drinking. I want you and my family member to support me. And then, you know, my mom, when she had dementia, she forgot the last 66 years of her life. And she certainly wasn't going to remember
That
she'd made that decision. So when she's asking for ice cream, I'm going to give her ice cream.
Right.
And, you know, when someone has a bad stroke, and or most people, actually, toward the end of life, especially in dementia, but in other conditions, get to a state where they have trouble swallowing.
Right.
And then we go through this whole thing about, oh, if we feed them, they might get aspiration pneumonia. And, you know, we've trained our dietitians and others that we can do what we call comfort feedings. Let them eat and drink what they want. Small bites, sips of fluids. If they cough, that's okay. But I wouldn't ever want to hold food or water from somebody who's begging for it.
And back to the kind of the world of, not necessarily rescue medicine, but this the kind of the imperative... and the state's option and right to insert itself into protecting life and those kind of things, that comes to play a lot within those regulated environments, long-term care settings, where you really have to vocalize your wishes and desires at that point in terms of, like, moving to comfort feedings rather than requiring mom to go in and sit for... And in some cases, it may take an hour and a half to feed her, and that's fine, and we should be able to do that. But we also have to realize there's some perverse incentives in that system. Well, it'd be a lot easier if we just put a feeding tube in her, because then we don't have to spend the hour and a half with the staff person every day trying to get her to eat something. And so your insistence with that situation to say, we need her to be fed, we are not going to, and Anne can talk to you about the clinical problems associated with feeding tubes with people with advanced dementia. The evidence just isn't there that we should be doing it. And so it does, again, it's incumbent upon the families to step forward and say, here's the natural course of care. These are the goals of care. These are the treatments. These are the values and the preferences that need to be woven into the care of this person that I love. And I think that's the issue that most of us really need to be able to articulate.
They had been feeding with a syringe, and that was, I mean, they kept feeding her whether she wanted to or not, or in that stage. And the law had been changed so that they were allowing a patient in that situation that was to say, I don't want to eat anymore by refusing. And that I think they had to have our permission to do a feeding tube or continue feeding. So I was sort of impressed by that change in the law had been made.
Yeah, that's somewhat enlightened. Nursing homes are given deficits if patients have unexplained weight loss, and so that's why it's a big, big issue for them. One of the protections is, as John said, to put the patient on hospice, because then the criteria are not as strict. Yeah, but some patients don't qualify for hospice who are having troubles eating. Years ago, when feeding tubes first became available, it was just thought, well, they're not eating well or they're not swallowing well, so they must have a feeding tube. But going back 20 years now, we have good data that shows that putting a feeding tube into a dementia patient does not prolong their life, could hasten death, and certainly causes more episodes of pneumonia, often cuts off what little social contact they have because somebody just comes in and hangs the bag and then walks out of the room rather than spending an hour trying to feed them. So for many, many reasons, it's not being offered as often. But I remember a case we had at the center years ago of a little lady in a nursing home in Kansas City, Kansas, that didn't have an advance directive and didn't have a family member who could speak for her and had dementia. And she had a feeding tube. Hers was, I think, through the nose, but it might have been through the stomach, the normal way. But anyway, she pulled it out 17 times. She wasn't capable of making her own decisions, but she seemed to be indicating a choice. But the doctors felt obligated to put it back in because she couldn't make her own decisions. Finally, they found a second cousin in Florida who really hadn't seen her in many, many years, but was willing to sign that that was the appropriate thing to do, and the poor lady was able to get rid of the tube.
And there's pretty good evidence. Joan Tino out of Brown University has done a lot of study on this issue, which some of the research that Anne's referring to, that it's not as bad as it used to be, but at one point, about 30% of all people who were receiving dementia patients in nursing facilities in the United States that were receiving feeding tubes, there was no discussion around the medical need to insert it. So that was really kind of a haunting statistic that we were, those of us in the end of life care, were saying, what decision is driving this? I mean, what discussion is driving this? What effort to involve the family, find a second cousin or anything like that? It just... And again, back to those perverse incentives, they got paid to do it, you know, and that our system of healthcare in the United States is set up to maximize reimbursement. And we've all agreed that that's a system we are okay with by the fact that we've got health, for-profit health system in both in the health plan side and on the provider side. So, you know, that boat sailed a long time ago. I would agree. Not everybody agrees that we've benefited from that. But, you know, it's the reality of life. I'd like to go back a minute, too, and talk a little bit about other ways that you can document your wishes and values in language that makes sense to you. One, I think, is particularly important. I see Mary Kay here. Ethical wills are a great way to do that. And you've got an expert right here in the room who can help you with that, and I really encourage you to do it. It is really a beautiful narrative of your life that kind of goes through. It's a legacy gift for your family, but also goes into very specific things about the things that are most important to you. And the center's work has really been trying to amplify that in the course of our documents. We have our Caring Conversations book, and we've got the documents in there. But what we really do is say, name an agent, and then have a conversation with that person. And that's what our book tries to do, is to try to take you through that course of a conversation in terms of the things that you want. And the most important thing is to be able to capture the values and the preferences you have in terms of things that are meaningful to you. Sharing a meal, a relationship with a God, the importance of your family, what gifts you have to leave. And those can be great resources when the families then are faced by Anne coming in the room and saying, you guys, this isn't working and we need to come up with another plan. What can we do to make sure that we honor your mother in this next step. Those kinds of discussions inform that. The tools that we're developing, right now we kind of rely on the book and that kind of stuff. However, we're getting ready to enter into an agreement with an organization that will allow us to capture in video form on your phone and audio on your phone that can be uploaded into the cloud that can be retrieved at a later time so that you can then reflect on what it was that mom or dad said or your sister. We had a case recently with 11 children in the emergency room of a local hospital screaming at each other because the mother had named the oldest and the youngest, and they disagreed on the care that she was supposed to receive. And in the course of the conversation, this is how bizarre this got. In the course of the conversation, Linda asked, where is your mother right now? And she said, well, she's in the room. And she's like, is she sedated? Is she unconscious? And she goes, oh, no. And she said, what do you mean, oh, no? And she said, no, she's perfectly fine. We're just all sitting around here on the hallway screaming at each other. And she said, well, wait a minute. Has anybody asked your mother what she would want right now? And you know, the kind of the first principle of autonomy and you know, self-organizing, you know, this woman had capacity. And nobody was looking at her because it was in a crisis moment in terms of, you know, rescue medicine taking over again. So I don't know how it got resolved. I just know that we kind of diminished the screaming and the ranting and said, okay, let's get mom involved in the conversation. So my point is, I think there's lots of ways for us to engage family in those discussions and really honor the person's wishes in ways of capturing that.
And the value of having the video is that if that patient no longer is able to participate in the conversation, which is when a lot of these decisions are being made, that brings them back into the room. There's nothing like seeing their face and hearing their voice saying it.
Calms down everybody.
Yeah, I think the hard thing about doing advanced directives and being clear about what you want is it all depends. In what circumstances would I want that? I've written a letter to go with my advanced directive, and it says things like, I would want treatments that would be a bridge to recovery. So I might want a ventilator if I was going to get off it and return to normal life, but I wouldn't want to be stuck on it. And so that is to give some guidance that people can give. In certain cases, there would be a reasonable trial. If I can no longer make my own decisions, there could be a trial of aggressive treatment, but there's a stopping point.
And we'll now do questions and answers, and everybody gets a chance to ask one question. If we'll start the question and answers right now, that'll be fine. I'll let you call on people.
Thank you. This was an excellent discussion. And, of course, we could do this for another 3 hours and there'd be lots more topics. As a physician, internal medicine with a geriatrics subspecialty, I beg my patients to do a living will. And I would say I probably get about 50% compliance. And I am really forceful in it. And I'm very clear that 90% of the time these are never used. These are documents that only come into play if you can no longer tell us what you want. But it seems to me, and this is a question I don't know if you addressed, I apologize, I was about 10 minutes late, but it seems to me like this is part of our culture in the United States of believing that death is somehow, number one, shouldn't happen, number two, somebody's fault if it does.
I tried to do that the same thing with my geriatric patients and probably had about the same success rate. Hey, it's interesting to me that the lawyers have figured this out and they have convinced at least a lot of people that you won't die right away if you make a will or, you know, set up an estate. But when we talk to people about their health care plan, they say, oh, no, I'm not ready for that yet. You know, it's such a gift to the family. I have concerns, as many in the bioethics field do, that the advanced directives, once completed, are not often achieving what was intended, that they're sometimes ignored. But the combination of documenting, at least naming the person to decide for you, and having the conversation with that person are so key. And I don't know what we can do except keep encouraging people to take the burden off their family when the time comes. It's for the family.
We have a go ahead and come up. We have a joke in the hospice world that says Americans are the only people on the planet who consider death an optional event. So, unfortunately. It's getting better, though. I really do think it's getting better. I think Just with the 2014 report and then all the on end of life and then also the Aspen report that just came out last week. So I think we're getting there.
I just had a question about out-of-hospital do not resuscitate orders. My understanding that they are to be signed by the patient and the doctor. And I had a father-in-law who passed last year at 101, who luckily only spent a few days in hospice, and it never really came to play. But my thought was that, you know, this thing was signed by him and his doctor well over a year before he died, and his doctor actually retired before he died. So I was curious if these things have some kind of shelf life.
Kansas and Missouri, we can use outside the hospital do not resuscitate orders. An advanced directive or living will does not get you out of resuscitation when 911 is called. You have to have this particular form, the out-of-hospital DNR. It does not have a shelf life or an expiration date. It is considered an order. Sometimes the document is not produced when it's needed. Sometimes it gets ignored. So it's not perfect, and John can talk about the center is working on a system that is really actually a doctor's order for not only that, but other limitations.
Right, and it's called Transportable Physician's Orders for Patient Preferences. The acronym is TPOP, and we are now active in the Kansas City area. To address the issue of the how often or how frequently is it looked at, the requirements of the order are that if there's any change in the patient's, significant change in the patient's condition, or if there is a change in location of care, that the document must be reviewed and updated. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily signatures change, but there is a new date or whatever that's on it to say, yes, this is the same as it used to be. The other thing is it is a different document, as Ann said, that is a different document than the Kansas out-of-hospital do not resuscitate directive, which is initiated by the patient. This is an actual physician order, and it covers more than just resuscitation. It covers feeding tubes. It covers admission to the ICU. It's a whole host of things.
Good morning. I want to try to ask a question looking 15 to 20 years down the road. We know we're entering the front end of the boomer generation. Happen to sit right on the edge of the edge. But I'm also very involved these days in big data, Internet of Things, and a bunch of stuff that basically is, from where I sit, creating a tension between the sort of emotional intelligence that you've been talking about and the increasing reliance in healthcare and insurance on what I'll call machine intelligence, algorithms and profiling. And so I guess I'd like your thoughts about whether or not this wave of boomers passing through, building on the experience of palliative care and hospice and now Oregon and some other states, is there a potential that there could be a tipping point that in terms of the American view of healthcare with pay for, you know, insurance and so on? I realize that's a large question. If there are people who are working on and studying that, I definitely would be interested in knowing. Thank you.
Thanks. It's been said that the baby boomers think it's all about us. And so I think that there is a big chance that with such a large demographic wave dying, that it will not only increase the number of conversations around death and dying and perhaps make it more acceptable, but will certainly also increase the amount of control that people want over their death and dying. So I've been hopeful for a number of years that the baby boomer transition would help with that. We invented teenageism, whatever that is, and you know we're going to have an impact on death and dying. Your comments about the Internet of Things and machine data and that sort of thing make me worry, though, a little bit that, you know, if we get enough data points and we believe that that tells us a prognosis, then we may be at a point where they say, well, we're not going to invest any further aggressive care in your case because, you know, it's all downhill from here anyway.
That risk, and then also on the precision medicine of me being able to know specifically what drugs work for me and what drugs don't. I think that's a huge factor in terms of our being able to decide whether or not certain patients with certain kinds of cancer who have certain genetic profiles aren't going to be able to benefit from certain kinds of treatment anymore. And in the past, we gave it to everybody because it was kind of standard of care. And now we're saying, we know this doesn't work, but sorry, you're out of luck. We don't have anything for you. So those kinds of things in terms of big data and how we're going to be able to decide what kinds of treatment work for what people, and then are we obligated to provide that to them, or are we going to say, no, that's a waste of resources and we're not going to give you that? So a lot of questions around big data. We are looking at it. Dr. Mark Hoffman at Children's Mercy, formerly UMKC, this is an area of work that he's been devoting his life to, and he's particularly interested in the questions around end of life. So it locally as well as nationally, it's a big issue, yes.
But we might know which pain medicine works.
That is true. So it's a both and. I mean, there's good news here too as well. We just had a young colleague of ours who presented on robotics and artificial intelligence and the ability for bots to crawl the internet and read research and facilitate research in an extensive way that we've never been able to do before. So you rely on your doctor now to have read the most recent journals on your disease and be an expert, and they have bots now that do that and then put the information together and tell the doctor, this is the best course of treatment on this patient, because we've looked at all these studies and there was 20 here and 16 there, but they were genetically different, or phenotype was different than they were. Regardless of genotype, and we know these kinds of things work and those don't. So there's a lot of information out there that we're going to be able to do, and there's both good and bad on this, as there is with any advance in medicine.
Thank you for being here. Yes, just the subject I was going to touch upon is a final exit network, which based on, a book by Derek Humphrey, he wrote about 25 years ago.
Yeah, the final exit network, though, is very different than
right.
than Derek's.
But I think his writings, it spurred some of the later thoughts on that. And for some people, myself included, I'm not really interested in the glories of the last journey of life, laying somewhere unconscious and suffering, either for myself or my family members. So anyway, I'm interested in the options of suicide, whether it be physician-assisted or otherwise, if it comes to that point when it's appropriate and, I think, enlightened to pick the moment of death and to take care of those obligations to our loved ones in an appropriate setting of our own choosing. And I was, maybe it is a plug for the Final Exit Network, which I belong to, which I find enlightening. And it does provide some information on suicide.
Yes, it does.
In ways. And so anyway, I'll just, if you have any comments on that.
And they're featured in the suicide plan. They're extensively, as is Compassion and Choices, which is the other
right.
group that promotes aid in dying.
Right.
Both of those are really more focused on the individual, not waiting for society to get, you know, approval that doctors do
right.
this, but allow for resources and ways for individuals to seek a solution to their final exit.
I confess, though, that when Derek Humphrey's book, Final Exit, came out, I was in practice, and I didn't actually buy the book and read the whole thing, but I did go to the bookstore and open it to find what he recommended that people ask their doctors for, so I know if people were asking for that prescription, what they were about.
And there's some aspects to Caring Advocates that also, the one I mentioned earlier in California, that does the very specific planning for your voluntary stopping of eating and drinking. So that's another group. Caring Advocates is another group that does that.
Hi. So I'm kind of just wanting to ask a question about something that you had expressed earlier. As you've said, older generations that have experienced and were expected to take care of the sick or dying relatives of their sick or dying relatives are now making decisions to not receive the care that younger generations are less expected to undertake. But because of that, how do we approach the process of care that philosophically we need to return to experience, you know, what we are going to experience one day?
I think that came up in our family when my mother had advanced dementia. Ira Bacchus talked about it in one of his books, that it is such a gift to a family member to allow them to care for you. And you know, I have a friend who is a Buddhist practitioner and very much wants to be focused on her you know, spiritual state at the end of life. She says, I want to say goodbye to my family 2 weeks before, because having them around is just going to make me more attached to this life. I want to be moving on to the next phase. But how hard that is for the family. It's not that the family sees, it is a burden. There's no question about it. But it is such a gift to be able to participate, to provide that care, to get up at night time after time with my mom to make sure she was okay in the bathroom. You know, all those things that we want to do, we want to care for others. It's our human nature. And if people say, oh, I don't want to be a burden, and push us away, that's a painful thing too. And I don't mean to imply that people who choose assistance in dying never have a good resolution with their family, because some do it very well. And one thing I didn't touch on is most people who choose assistance in dying are well-educated, white, and have good financial incomes. Yeah. So.
And another point to kind of piggyback on that, we had a case. I worked in hospice care for a long time, and we had a case of a young woman who was dying at 30-some years old, and two small children from different spouses, and had been introduced to drugs at the age of 9 years old by her mother. So she had basically a liver that was not metabolizing anything, and she had horrible, horrible pain. It could not get control over it because it was just, she had no resistance to the pain medication. We went through palliative sedation with that family, and I am certain that there was acceptance of the fact that we hastened her death through that process. It was a very difficult process. We followed all the protocols. But that family was very much at peace with this. So even though it was a tough decision for them, and we had lots of moving parts with kids that were couldn't giving certain permission to say goodbye by the dad, and dad wasn't connected to the family and all that kind of stuff, it was, I think, for the sake of, you know, people die the way they live, and none of our lives are perfect. So we have to be accommodating to the wishes and desires and openness of that family in that situation. And that was a tough situation, but it is clear within my mind that we assisted that family making the best decision possible, even though we hastened the death of that young woman.
The event of a death lives on in the life of the loved ones for the remainder of their lives. And how it goes, whether they found some peace and some closure, some gift of connection, that's going to have an impact on them for the remainder of their lives.
We got time for one more quick question. Okay, two really quick
questions. It's somewhat, I'll try to be quick, please. You mentioned my experience with my mother and the argument that you termed the argument. It was more of a negotiation. I would like you to comment upon the assumption that medical professionals assume that the family wants the care. And that when we had to go through a process of saying what were the ramifications of a hip surgery at age 98, and they were telling us that she would probably die in the surgery, and it was going, and so we had to analyze every, but one of the point that I would like you to comment on was, as a family, and we had our directives on our cell phones, you know, and everything, as soon as we convinced them that we were not going to sue them, that changed the direction of the event.
So. Okay, one really quick question.
Another book, an MD, Making Rounds with Oscar, very pertinent to the Oscar, by the way, is a cat. Who makes the choice? Who decides competency, and what are those criteria?
It's a question of, does this person have capacity to make certain decisions, which is different from the legal determination of incompetency. So basically, is do they understand the question? Do they understand the implications of choosing yes or no, right or wrong? Can they communicate that? And does it make sense in accordance with, you know, their life values and so forth? So it's a very subjective judgment.
Yeah, competency is determined by the courts. Capacity is determined by the physician that's involved with the patient, or the clinical team that's involved with the patient. And just because you can't understand the complexity of a particular procedure does not mean you do not know who your daughter is and you love her. So deferring to that individual to make your decisions for you is still important, and that's still important for the clinical team to know, because that's the level at that you have capacity and you participate in those discussions where you have the capacity to participate.
Great. Thank you very much. And yeah, in lieu of a real honorarium, we'd like to present you our U.S.-made mugs. Next week is a very interesting program, Homeland Security's Policing for Profit, which is by John Adams, an analysis of the for-profit penal system, which will be, I think, pretty unusual. And also, you're welcome to stay for the 11:15 service, and both John and Ann will be available in the meeting room, which is just out there and to the left, in just a few minutes. So if you have any other comments or speeches, you can make speeches there.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, Aid in Dying, with Ann Allegra and John Carney. This program was recorded on Sunday, April 9th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within 10 days of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, where we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.